Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the New Books Network podcast on Jewish studies. I am your host today, James Nadel, and I'm joined by Dr. Kenneth Moss, the Harriet and Ulrich E. Meyer Professor of Jewish History at the University of Chicago. Dr. Moss's first book, Jewish Renaissance in the Russian Revolution, came out in 2009 and examined the works of Eastern European Jewish intelligentsia during the time of the Russian Civil War. His most recent book, which we will be discussing today, An Unchosen People, Jewish Political Reckoning in Interwar Poland, which was published last year by Harvard University Press. As we will discuss, An Unchosen People follows the transformation of Polish Jewish social thought and political reason in the late 1920s up until the mid-1930s in the face of rising ethno-nationalism and anti-Semitism in Poland during that period. Professor Moss, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks so much. Thanks, James. I'm glad to be here.
Great. So I'll start by just asking how you came to this study in the first place of Polish Jewry in this 1928 to 1935 moment. Why was it in this moment in particular that certain Polish Jews started to describe the situation, their situation in the region as quote unquote futureless?
Yeah, I think there's sort of two ways of answering that question. One is to say, of course, it wasn't only in this period, and it was even more the case in the much more obvious period of the late 30s after Pilsudski's death, after the Sanacja, the inheritors of his movement, tack hard to the right to try and draw off, you know, the support growing for the hard right. Obviously, there was a great deal of very grim thinking about the likely unfolding of the future around Jews in Poland in those years. And in some sense, because this is a book that was interested in new forms of Jewish thought taking shape or efforts to think toward clarity about what might be a new situation taking shape around one, I actually discovered that the much less viscerally threatening period before Pilsudski's death and the hard right turn of the Sanacja is more interesting. You know, it was a moment when all sorts of outlooks on the future were to be found amongst Polish Jews, but a quite disparate group of people, disparate in terms of their ideological commitments, their class background, their relationship to thought, intellectuals, but also ordinary people, began to wrestle with much grimmer possibilities than the sort of muddling through toward some kind of political integration that I think was the general hope of most Polish Jews. And why that period should have had that effect in thought. I mean, I think what's interesting about that period is precisely its mix of rather disparate circumstances. I mean, you have a constellation of a real cultural complexity. Poles of Jewish background, Jewish Poles, Polish Jews are Polonizing very quickly, although they remain quite internally, culturally, varied. Economic disaster, the economic disaster of the Great Depression hits Poland relatively early and very hard. So all sorts of development, hopes about development that you could kind of sustain through a good part of the 20s are suddenly called into question. In sort of waves that get larger and larger, all sorts of rather increasingly terrifying political phenomena look to be moving from the margins to the mainstream. And I want to emphasize, not just or even necessarily primarily in Poland per se. One important point that became clear to me in part through the work of Lenda Czajka and other Polish historians, but also through my own reading, is just how impactful the rapid rise of Nazism in Germany was for Polish Jews who cared to look beyond the specifics of that rise in a German setting and to ask how it is that a movement committed to the total and violent undoing of emancipation achieved could move from the margins to the center so robustly in a society, in a polity with much higher institutional walls of both liberalism and socialist opposition than Poland could muster. So, and then a last dimension of this period that's so fascinating to me, and this is also particularly true of the early 30s more than the late 20s, is the sudden reemergence at an unprecedented scale, although never as large as it was hoped to be, of a very peculiar possibility of Jewish exit, which is, of course, Palestine, which for their own reasons, the British reopened to Jewish immigration at a much higher level than it had previously been open, although again, much lower than could have met the very robust demand. And in a moment when other options for immigration were either legally and practically foreclosed or just essentially, practically unattainable. So all these aspects of the larger political situation, to me, make this period a kind of forcing bed for a growing number, not everybody, not necessarily almost everybody, but a growing number of Polish Jews to begin thinking about first of all, to seek understanding of the linkages of economic crisis, majoritarian nationalism, populism, democracy as a claim on the state, anti-Semitic enmity. All of these things are growing in different ways, intermixing in different ways. And I was interested at the level of intellectual history in people who try to understand, well, what are the relations of these things? Are they taking new forms? Are these new constellations? Are forms of enmity and rage in new parts of Polish society toward Jews, are they simply a product of the Great Depression? Even if they are a product of the Great Depression, does that mean that they'll go away when the Depression subsides? What will happen in the meantime? These are kind of questions that emerge precisely in the framework of this unusual and confounding constellation of new phenomena. So that's I think a place to begin that answering that question.
Yeah, and it seems this convergence of these various factors really sets this period apart from what came before. And I was wondering if you could put a fine point on the distinction in the enmity that we're seeing in this period to compare it perhaps to similar or different moments of anti-Semitism in Tsarist Russia or earlier in the history of the Polish Republic.
Well, one thing I want to underscore that I work hard to underscore in the book, and I mean, one will see what people think and what they take away. But although the question of what is anti-Semitism? Is it always effect or also cause? How quickly is it metastasizing? And what does it mean to the people who, in some sense, are being pulled toward it? Although those questions were interesting to and pressing for many of the contemporaries I study and are interesting to me, I want to underscore that the political thinking about the sort of prospect that Jews are facing what is likely to be a bad future in Poland, but generally in Europe, that I focus on in this book are not in the first instance sort of organized around the question, how much anti-Semitism is there, and is it worse in Poland than anywhere else? And actually, most of the figures I study, certainly the intellectuals, appreciate just how complicated the situation is in Poland. The Polish political culture was divided, deeply divided, that's part of the issue, along all sorts of lines. Polish nationalism itself was bifurcated between an increasingly and intensely anti-Semitic right-wing vision and an older, in some ways more established, integrative vision that did have a place for Jews. Someone like Pilsudski kind of falls into that category, I think. So one thing I want to underscore is that for the thinkers I am interested in, for whom I can kind of give some kind of account of the genesis of their worries, the worries in the first instance were seldom about intensity of anti-Semitism per se. They were about some growing sense that in a new state suffering through developmental problems in an age of ethno-nationalism and populism and new kinds of expectations from society toward the state and new kinds of metastases of nationalism itself, all of these things looked much, at least to the people I'm studying, not everybody saw this way, but a lot of them taken together looked very dangerous because it seemed that they that most of the ways they could break, most of the forms they could take in tandem with each other would mean a lot of social pressure for the state or society itself to see the Jews as a problem, as an obstacle to the common weal and the happiness of real Poles, if you will, after, obviously in quotes, and as something that had to be solved, right? As the question, but also problem that had to be solved. And that's not simply in the mind of my thinkers, and I think they're right about this. That's never understood primarily as a function of something like the question, how many of this or that members of this or that polity are deeply anti-Semitic as opposed to a little anti-Semitic as opposed to philo-Semitic, right? It had to do with a sort of sense that, and you can spin this out a couple different ways. So several of the thinkers, the analysts I'm interested in chapter four particularly, are interested in not just the spread of anti-Semitism, but also in what we could call sort of inchoate political science forms of inquiry. Like how many people, how large a minority do you have in the society that really does hate group X for the balance of control over the range of things the larger society can and can't consider doing realistically vis-a-vis group X to change? put that less bloodlessly, when the Zionist activist Alter Drianov goes to Poland in late 31, spends about 6 months there, he spends a lot of time talking to different Zionist figures, and he reports a sharp disagreement amongst the Zionists in Galicia, historically the place where Jews were most, a particular group of Jews were most deeply and fully Polonized, between those Zionists and Zionist leaders in Warsaw. And the Zionist leaders in Warsaw are sure that that even within Pilsudski's Sanacja, real anti-Jewish sentiment is taking greater and greater hold amongst some of the leadership and governing strata. And the Zionists in Galicia don't think this is right. They think that's just these guys are not anti-Semites. They're pretty, they're pretty inured against that kind of stuff. They're genuine Pilsudskites and so forth. They believe in integration. But Drianov's point is that worrisomely, this is kind of a distinction without a difference. If no matter what the attitudes of the policymakers are vis-a-vis Jews, they feel constrained by a larger public pressure to engage in a kind of, Ausrottungspolitik, a kind of driving the Jews out of the economy and society politics. And there are other dimensions that I haven't just scored out for. There's also a special interest among people I'm studying in anti-Semitism in places where it really matters. So amongst young people in the elite, right? I mean, the universities are a hotbed, as they were in Germany, a hotbed of intense anti-Semitism, as well as a hotbed of interesting kinds of philo-Semitism or mobilized anti-Semitism, but a hotbed of anti-Semitism. And what does that mean when the inheritors of state power over the next 10 to 20 years are the fiercest, most committed, and most extreme visionaries of solving the Jewish problem through violence or something robust, right? That's a question my thinkers had to ask.
Yeah. And do you see that as a fundamentally new, complex as compared to, I guess, the functioning of the imperial state, for instance?
I think a couple things are new. In general, yes. My sense, for instance, of the Russian intelligentsia was that, and here I'm just following, I think this is fairly clear. There certainly were robust and increasingly Baroque versions of anti-Jewish sentiment in parts of the Russian intelligentsia, but on the whole, very clearly, and this is reflected especially in what happens around in the 1905 revolution, very clearly larger and larger parts of the Russian intelligentsia and the whole realm of sort of educated society had come to recognize that, anti-Semitism was one of the many forms of reaction in the arsenal of a Tsarist authoritarian regime that they generally understood as an obstacle to their own happiness. So, the late great historian Jonathan Frankel makes this point that the violence of anti-Semitic, the intensity of anti-Semitic violence in 1905, 1906 in many Russian cities, in sort of the great wave of pogroms, was off the charts, unprecedented relative to anything come before. But it didn't generate the same kinds of despair amongst many Jews because so clearly it was linked to a rightist counter-revolutionary project, and it was so clearly counterbalanced by more and more of Russian society recognizing that this kind of anti-Semitism was part of the problem, not part of the solution. I think it's very different to think about the situation of a minority in a polity increasingly shaped by ethno-nationalism and committed from the get-go, and this is certainly not true only of Poland. We can think about a lot of other examples, for some very close to home in Jewish studies, a polity committed to the special needs, so-called, of the real nation, whatever else it thinks about other citizens in its frame. And in that sense, if we want to look for a pre-1918 version that I wish I could have thought more about, I don't really say anything about it in this, but I think it's a kind of frontier worth studying. I think we might want to look back to late 19th century Romania as a long-term story of nationalists in power who just can't quite escape feeling that the Jews are a real problem and have to be treated as a socio-political problem, although you can vary your views of how one ought to approach that.
Let's turn to some of these thinkers that you studied and their process of, as you put it at certain points in the book, groping for solutions in the situation in Poland. Certain figures like Uriel Weinreich and Jacob Leczczynski and Chaim Grade come up time and again in the book. And I wonder if you could describe some of their analyses of the situation, how they changed over the course of their intellectual life, and where else, to what other minority issues they looked to try to better grasp what they were experiencing.
Yeah, these are figures very close to my heart. I do want to also note, in some ways, it's interesting that our discussion, and this is close to my heart too, has kind of hewed to the, let's call it, the more formally intellectual history dimensions of the project, the kind of middle of the book. I would want to note sort of, and maybe I should have taken a big step back, how much the book is actually an effort to find forms of thinking happening not only in formal settings of inquiry, analytical journalism, sociology, if you will, but also amongst ordinary people, and what all these folks share. Before I turn to some of these, these intellectuals that we know something about, what the folks share, the folks who kind of come into my viewfinder share, is a twofold growing recognition. First, and we've talked about this part of it, that it's more and more reasonable to think that the likely futures facing Polish Jewry are unhappy ones for the most part. But also, and this is going to be important for thinking about the sort of the last part of the book, which in some ways I think is the heart of the book, which turns from thought to politics, if you will, they also are grappling with a new sense that a lot of their previous and longstanding assumptions about Jewish collective political capacities to substantially affect their situation through self-organization, through politics, may have been strongly overstated. And in fact, Jews may have very little collective power to substantially shape, much less avert, any of the bad futures that that seem reasonably, you know, likely. So that's one. That's a large. And so, and then within that, I look at, you know, crudely speaking, ordinary people and intellectuals. And here, let's turn to some of the intellectuals that you ask about, because that's those recognitions are the double framework for a lot of their thought. Their thought, the thought of figures like Max Weinreich, Jacob Leschinsky, and others. Their thought, I think, in turn, is best understood as bifurcating between two basic questions. What is all of this doing to us, to the Jews, psychologically, socially, culturally? And then on the other hand, what's going on in the larger society? And crudely speaking, chapter 3 sort of about folks who ask themselves, what sort of impact is this sense of prolonged, of exclusion, likely bad futures and forms of despair and hopelessness, what sort of impact is this having on our community and its culture and its political options, its capacity to imagine political options? And then chapter 4 looks at often very similar folks, although more of them Zionists than diasporists. We could talk about that distinction if you like, who instead are asking the kind of questions we sort of led our discussion with. What's going on in the larger society, both Polish and, let's say, more generally modern European? And vis-a-vis the former, the folks thinking about what this is, what is becoming of us under these circumstances, one of the figures you mentioned was in some ways, you know, my kind of Virgil, if you want to invoke a very un-Jewish intertext, as I entered this project. I spent a lot of time with him. In some ways, I had to leave him behind at a certain point because I think his thought limits itself to this question: what is going on inside a Jewish community increasingly shot through with a sense of being targeted for extrusion? And this is this figure, Max Weinreich, a figure who is, you know, the great pioneer, certainly a great pioneer of serious Yiddish linguistic philology, a person who, if he'd been left alone by history, would have devoted all of his life to what he started his life as intellectual adult life with, which was intense Yiddishist effort of the sort that I focus on a lot in my first book. You know, he's a figure who appears at the margins of my first book as a young man. He undertakes to translate chapter 9 of Homer's Iliad, the Weindark Sea chapter, and parts of the Gilgamesh epic into Yiddish. And what this reflects is a wonderfully intense, but actually quite typical, you know, sort of Yiddishist vision that Jews have it in their hands to define who they are as a nation. The nation is a general regulative concept here, albeit in a very progressive mode that doesn't have to do with statehood, but has to do instead with forms of taking one's traditional culture and cultural inheritances and turning them into new secular forms of human creativity in one's own language, et cetera, right? So, you know, this is his. He's the founding figure and guiding figure of the YIVO Institute. But then at a certain point, as Barbara Kirschenbach-Gimlet and others helped us understand really already about, you know, 20 years ago, maybe more, he takes a hard turn toward a strange sort of project of self-retraining in social psychology. And this is linked at the root to a hard turn toward being very, very interested, unsurprisingly actually, in understanding better what the younger generation of Polish Jews take to be their own situation. This is a guy who's the father of two adolescent boys, right, in this period. So, and he initiates this famous Jugendforschung, youth research project. He initiates the project that collects hundreds of autobiographies in all three languages of Polish Jewish life, Yiddish, Polish, and Hebrew. And he's the first to really try and actually look at these autobiographies, the ones from 32 and 34, and figure out what's going on. And what he actually says once he finishes sort of clearing his throat in the first 100 pages of a very long book he writes about this is, you know, holy crap. You know, these kids are really the main phenomenon you find when you look, if you figure out one, if there's one phenomenon that he sees in a lot, though not all, of these autobiographies, it's deep despair about the future and a sense that one's Jewishness is bad fate, right? And you can see him. I mean, he doesn't like this, and he spends a lot of the book he writes about it called Der Weg zu unserer Jugend, mobile, and this is a point that Barbara Kirschenblatt-Gimlet makes so well, mobilizing various kinds of sort of youth psychology models to argue that a lot of this is bad thinking. It's compensatory. It's people, you know, it's in itself as a problem because if you despair, you can't wrestle realistically with life and all this stuff. Yeah, that's, but right in the middle of all of this, before he pivots to kind of indicting the youth for a despair that itself is sort of undermining, he begins to investigate, you know, what kind of thing is this to imagine yourself part of a immiserated minority targeted by the majority society, or at least a substantial part of it, for some kind of extrusion in ways that look like, you know, at best they'll be interminable, right? I mean, he doesn't really flirt very strongly with the idea they might be terminable, but they'll, at best they'll be a lot, this will be a sort of a siege. And he starts to ask himself questions he'd never asked before. Like, does this mean that Jews in Eastern Europe are more like German Jews, or for that matter, African Americans, particularly middle class African Americans, than they are like normal nations, to use Weinreich's own terms? And he, in a very fraught and very problematic way, begins seriously to try and know something about African American life, particularly that of the folks that Du Bois and others would call the talented tenth, the people who do have access to institutions of higher education and so forth, but who are living in this milieu which tells them constantly, and not just tells, but shows them constantly that they're not allowed in for when push comes to shove. And of course, much worse than that in many ways. And you can see him wrestling. He doesn't like this comparison. He'd rather be able to dismiss this comparison, but he starts to develop a conceptual language that begins to ask whether Polish Jews are vectoring on something like the German Jewish situation of not really having any compensatory certainty in their own capacities for positive difference and self-determination, but are instead a new kind of what he uses the peculiar term in this setting that we now use in Hebrew, miut, and that they suffer from miutishkeit or miutumschaft, which I've translated as minorityhood and minoritieshood. And, you know, to even make these comparisons marks a real shift for someone who had entered the interwar period absolutely convinced that Jews were a normal nation, indeed that they were they could be a beacon of what normal nationhood should be, you know, which meant cultural self-determination without the nasty political parts of it. And that kind of thinking struck me as, you know, worth thinking through, even though I don't know that how far he's able to take it. I mean, he's so torn about even making the comparison that he can't even, when pushing himself, he can't even tell his reader if he thinks it is actually the case that Polish Jews are more and more like, or the situation there is more and more like that of African Americans within the world of, you know, violent white supremacy. It's just he even says, and there's like, whether this condition applies to Polish Jews, I will not say. But here's all sorts of ways in which clearly it doesn't not. Right? This is a very strange kind of thinking, but one I wanted to draw out.
Maybe it makes sense then to compare it to someone who was a little bit more forthright, perhaps, in facing that conclusion. The Yiddish poet and novelist Chaim Grade, you mention in the book that he kind of embarks on this project of writing poetry that will act as some sort of fortifying element for Jews facing a sense of powerlessness in Poland. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the aesthetics of that poetry and how it differs or is similar to the poets and cultural activists that you studied in your first book or other Jewish artists and writers that you've encountered.
Yeah, I mean, I also want to begin by, you know, as in every book, you accumulate a lot of debts, and I want to note that this recognition of Grada's, the peculiarity of Grada's undertaking and some of its terms, I owe the starting points of that to Justin Cami and Avram Novostern. Camus notes that, that Grotta talks about and structures his whole, you know, much of his first book project, although it's a complicated story, around some notion of a kind of psychically reparative poetics. I think, I mean, in some ways, to think about the aesthetics of that, I found it helpful to think with another poet of the time who doesn't fall so squarely into the same project, although maybe she does more than I had a chance to think through, which is Deborah Fogel, a figure who's, you know, rightly drawn a lot of interest recently from a lot of different angles. Alison Schachter and my own colleague Anna Torres and others are studying her. And she has some interesting thoughts about that sort of look a little bit like Russian formalist thoughts about defamiliarization and the ways in which writers can make new certain kinds of notions through aesthetic experimentation. But she's particularly interested in ways in which this can be done for children. There's an interesting moment that she's writing in the 30s about, you know, about the kind of ways in which certain kinds of children's books operate better than others to convincingly embody in aesthetic form forms of imagination about the world for kids that obviously she likes, like forms of tolerance toward others who are different, forms of identification with others across differences. I think so. What I got interested in was Grotta looking for the same kind of effects directed not at children, but at really at his fellow young Vilna and Vilna area and Polish Jews. I think one way to think about his I'm not sure that I have that there's a useful way to sort of distill a particular aesthetics, but I do think that one way to think about this is what is not what he couldn't allow himself. And I open that chapter, which is chapter 3, by looking at a figure who stands in stark contrast. This figure, Hirsch Gutgestalt, a minor poet by any measure, who writes this very kind of, you know, he's a Bundist, a very active Bundist, and he writes this very Bundist-y socialist revolutionary poetry, right, in the same period that's sort of Sorellian in its vision. You know, we're let us all break our chains and march in the masses that will free the world and will burn down the old world and all this stuff, right? There's a kind of shorthand of self-organizing the sublime of sort of the liberatory violence, a conviction that we are powerful in masses, right? All this stuff finds its aesthetic form in ways that I think are not terribly surprising, although they might have been very moving for some readers. Grotta shares the same politics. He's clearly, broadly speaking, at least a lowercase s socialist. He understands human freedom and human oppression in terms that make sense in a broadly Marxian frame. But he just doesn't think that Jews should talk themselves into the foolish notion that they as a group are going to have any kind of real impact on where all this, what he calls the Weltkatastrophen, are going. And so if you can't do that, if it's dishonest to do that, and I think that's where he ends up, you have to ask if poetics can simply be a kind of litany of disaster, right? He does have this notion in a lot of his poetry that the poet's task is kind of the prophetic task in the darkest sense of the biblical narratives, to sort of just help force people to face how bad things are. But he doesn't abide in that, and he tries to find something like a new mythic ways of thinking about. He tries to provide resources for the reader to imagine him or herself as something other than subjected to catastrophe. And he does this in ways that I think are so idiosyncratic that I'm not sure you want to call them anesthetics. They're his sort of the Grottian. You know, he reaches for ideas about biological evolution to kind of give some sense of the ascending ladder of life as itself a vouchsafe of the humanity and worth of people, no matter how badly they are treated by history. And I think what the only thing you really say about this more generally as an aesthetics is that it depends on recognizing that poetry can't move people to effective action because there is no effective action to be taken. What it might be able to do is offer a different way of relating to one's own experience.
Yeah, that was what I thought was so fascinating about both Grada's poetry and the poetry of a Yiddish author that I've translated, Avram Sutzkever, that there's this sense of transfiguration you mention in the book, trying to have a different perspective on the objective facts of the situation.
Yeah, I mean, I think it helped me to think about that in you know.
For sure. So
I mean, Sutzkever in some ways is he's the figure that, I mean, I admire your translations of Sutzkever, by the way. I mean, he clearly is better at convincing himself of this and convincing others of it in his poetry than Grada. So in some ways, you know, I wish I could have spent more time with Sutzkever. He's a little too young, you know, and but of course, in some ways, he is the great bearer of this vision, even under the most extraordinary circumstances, to such a degree that, you know, as Weiss and other readers of Sutzkever pointed out, that, you know, during the Holocaust, his poetry sometimes dares to insist that it actually is salvific, or at any rate, that if one gives up on it, then one has given up on one's own self-salvation, right? It's anyway, he writes incredibly moving poetry that reassures one of one's own worth. So that's very much I think that's sort of what Grada was up to. I think Sutzkever, you know, does it under even more extreme far more extreme circumstances, and is a, you know, a better poet when push comes to shove. So, yeah. But that's a discussion for a different time. Maybe.
It's exciting to see that project, continue even under, as you said, those extreme and obviously worsening circumstances. So, as you mentioned earlier, this is not just the province of, you know, published intellectuals and famous artists in the canon, but as you said, this kind of groping and intellectual change is existing on a much broader social level. You talk about several times in the book about a movement of many Polish Jews to some sort of affiliation with Zionism during this period. Although, as you say, not necessarily an ideological Zionism, but what you call a vernacular one. Could you talk a little bit about that distinction? What did it mean to be a vernacular Zionist? And in what ways were Polish Jews both interested in Zionism and wary of it at the same time?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure how much I want to stake on the term vernacular Zionism. I mean, I move amongst a variety of terms, all of them with some kind of grounding in contemporary discourse, but all of them also quite distant from the actors themselves, and all of them driven by more basic sense, because the others that you see me kind of kick around in the book are Palestinianism, Yeshuvism. I'll come back to why I think it's useful to sort of bracket a phenomenon with these multiple terms. But the key to start with is the empirical baseline of this is, as you say, there is a massive engagement with and an even much more massive penumbra of interest in Zionism on the part of what can only be described as hundreds of thousands of Polish Jews, but I try and lay out why that's the right number to think with, many of whom, and by most accounts, most of whom, and I'm talking about the early 30s now, had previously had no connection to any of the worlds of organized Zionism. So one of the things I try and do in chapter 2 of the book, which is sort of in some ways the most social historical, kind of a social history of changing, of political searching, political skepticism, political thinking. And then I try and take up in more intellectual history terms, but from below, from talking about sort of ordinary people in later parts of the book. And one of the things I do as a baseline is I try and understand, obviously there were people who in their Zionism were very committed to various visions, positive visions, if you will, the actual programs of various Zionisms, you know, the creating of the new Jew, cultural regeneration, a cult of labor, in the case of labor Zionism, a cult of, the strong Jewish body and militancy in the case of revisionist Zionism, and arguably also labor Zionism, right? There, all these things are, there are plenty of people who think this, but they're a substantial minority, but by no means a majority. And then suddenly you get this influx of folks in the 30s, and all the evidence all the evidence shows that a substantial majority, or at least a plurality of them, had never had connections to Zionism before. So there's a poll of members of the Hechelutz movement in 1932, I have to try and remember exactly, yeah, 32, I think, which finds that 60% of the members had never had any connection to any of the institutions of organized Zionism before, Hebrew schools, Zionist organizations, Zionist youth groups. And all of this is played out in all kinds of qualitative sources as well. So you have this wonderful autobiography by a young man who complains that he wants to make, and he's saying, I'm quoting, he wants to make Aliyah to Eretz Yisrael, to the land of Israel. That is, he's thinking, he's a real Zionist. But all his friends who've joined the movement just want to, and again, I quote, emigrate to Palestine. So part of what I try to do in the book, again, building on very important work by other people, by Oppenheim's important work in Hebrew on Hechelutz, by the work of a young scholar and friend, Rona Yona, the work of Kamel Kiyak and Dan Heller, is just, you know, once just trying to make sense of what's driving these folks into Zionism. But much more important than that, because ultimately I think the answer is all sorts of things are driving them towards Zionism. Economic despair, political fear, all these the same things that are driving them in general towards skepticism about all of the old ideas on offer are the things driving them to look to get out. That in some sense strikes me as analytically straightforward and hard to go any further than that. I think what's interesting beyond that is to ask two things. One, what is the larger political cultural shift that this turn toward Zionism by previously unaffiliated people reflects? And part of the answer to that is a larger shift toward great skepticism about the alternative political sensibilities and projects on offer. And part of chapter two traces what seems to me a lot of evidence of mass outflux from socialist diasporist organizations, assimilationist circles, even Hasidic circles toward these kinds of Zionist affiliation. Even as obviously many people don't leave those camps. And then beyond that, I try in chapter five to think phenomenologically, if you will, and sociologically about what I think of as a new culture of inquiry, in which more and more people are increasingly skeptical about all of the versions of all of the mythic sensibilities on offer on the part of all of the different competing Jewish political programs, including Zionism. One of the things that really was important for me was to find in the Shlichim source, the sources of emissaries sent from Palestine or sometimes mobilized locally by organized labor and kibbutz Zionism to get a handle on all these young people flowing into the Hechelutz movement and to guide them toward proper ideological sensibility. And one of the things these Shlichim, the more discerning amongst them, are struck by and report on in interesting ways, in complicated ways, but clear ways, is how many of the young people who've joined the Zionist movements that they're looking at are not only not convinced of, not given over to Zionist visions of self-transformation and all the sort of, you know, all the singing and dancing, literally and figuratively, but are actually quite skeptical of those coming to Zionism with questions. They're not just desperate, nor are they ideologues. They have questions. And one of the things that I found in some of the few sources that let us go more sociologically and phenomenologically more deeply than that is young people recognizing exactly the same thing, saying, look, the number of people who really believe in any of the full-fledged programs and myths is declining, and it's small. Most of the people in any of the political camps, at least the young people, are asking questions. They know that nobody has any good answers. At least Zionism, this comes back to your initial question, gives them some shot, lets them get in line for a possibility of getting out. And even when they join these Zionist organizations, they are asking questions about what, if anything, is true in Zionist claims about the Yishuv, Palestine itself, Jewish life in Palestine itself, as different and better, if one can get to it, than what probably awaits an individual Jewish young person in the European diaspora. And those kinds of sensibilities of looking for real information, asking skeptical questions, thinking practically about what resources are available to you to change your circumstances, those strike me as, I think they're a very important part of a shift in the political culture, and they're very much at the heart of and found within and driving this strange and interesting expansion of engagement with Zionism.
But it's really fascinating to hear you talk about this kind of thought pattern that seems to transcend the political silos that I think the historiography sometimes places different Jews in Eastern Europe. You know, there's books about Bundists, there's books about Zionists, there's books about diasporists, all of these things. It seems to me more difficult to see the people who are moving in between these camps or are trying to are elaborating ideas that are not as easily categorized in any one of them. I wonder what is the process like, the methodology of finding that sort of supra-political sort of thought?
Or maybe interstitial thought.
Interstitial you use in the book. So did this start as a book about one political camp and then you realized it's the pattern is everywhere, or do you just try to look everywhere?
It's the latter. It didn't start that way at all. It started as a book that, I mean, I suppose it started with some presumption of the value of looking across multiple. I never thought to myself, I want to write about the ists, the this ists or the that ists in this book. Whereas, you know, my first book, When Push Came to Shove, I mean, I knew I wanted to write about Hebraists and Yiddishists. You know, and then I discovered, I think I discovered that that period was a particularly interesting place to think about them and what they were trying to do. But in this case, you know, the book started as a with a very broad gauged and very cultural historical question: how did East European Jews in the interwar period, living in new nation states, wrestle with sort of the cultural horizons that the nation, as something that might include them but also might exclude them, would mean for them? I have something very cultural historical like that. It took me a very long time to realize that my interest actually lay in new forms of thought about one's political circumstances and about how to understand the world a world of political possibilities and dangers. And there was no sort of aha archive where I found all my answers. And it took me a long, I mean, we all have excuses for why it takes us so long, those of us that take so long. But, you know, I think my excuse, insofar as there's a legitimate one, is it really did take this was a research process that involved gluing together lots and lots and lots of tiny pieces. I mean, it really is a mosaic of sources. There were a couple places that helped me, you know, a couple archival finds that helped me snap my thinking into place. So one of them was to go to Max Weinreich's archive, because I was interested in him as a Yiddishist thinker under the sort of cultural historical rubric, and then finding in there this amazing response by this figure, a young figure named, calls himself Benjamin Reisch. He's one of the 600 youth autobiographers, but uniquely, he also wrote a response to Weinreich's analysis of his generation and the sources they had provided. And that just happens to be sitting in Max Weinreich's archive at the Ivo Institute. And to find a young person saying, you know, your categories are wrong. We're all skeptics. The true believers, there are very few of them. The real story is something else. It's desperation and searching. That struck me. I mean, that was a turning point. The other turning point, I can't remember which came first, was to go to the archives of the Yad Tabenkin Institute for, you know, the kibbutz movement at Ramat Efal in Israel. And, you know, to find that the shlichim, when you go inside the archives of these emissaries, you know, 75% of what they write is, if you'll forgive me, sort of kibbutz movement claptrap. But 25% is them reflecting out loud as they write these reports home to Benkin and others, reflecting on the strangeness of what they're finding inside and around all these newly minted, you know, these newly expanded Zionist organizations. And their reflection on what they're finding totally connects to what that figure Benjamin Reisch was telling Weinreich from a very different cultural position, which was to say, these young people are, not all of them, but not a negligible number of them, are groping for understanding. They don't believe any of the ideologies anymore. They don't think there are any blueprints. They're worried, but they're not just panicking or something like that, a kind of trope you can find both in contemporary writing and I think too often in scholarship. They're asking hard questions. They want to know the answers. And they think they're in a position where, you know, they're really in trouble and that easy answers and ideological nostrums are not the way out of that trouble, if there is any, and they're not even sure of that. So that, you know, to discover that to me was really important. And it, you know, resonated too with our own circumstances today, to be perfectly frank about
it. Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that a bit. There's been kind of, in the last 4 or 5 years, several books about Eastern European Jewish life after World War I that are trying to, I think, capture the lived experience, the daily lived experience of anti-Semitism in and ethno-nationalism in that period between World War I and the Holocaust. Several come to mind, including Elisa Ben-Parad's Legacy of Blood, Jeffrey Weidlinger's recent In the Midst of Civilized Europe. And I wonder, do you have a sense of this set of books as a trend in the historiography, or that it will be viewed as such in retrospect? And to what extent, in your own thinking, were your conclusions affected by the past several years in American history?
Well, it's a lot easier for me to answer the second question. Yeah. I think very much so. You know, I'll note only in passing, you know, all the, in addition to the you know the important books you mentioned, I will just sort of give American or English speaking listeners a heads up that a young Polish, everyone's young at this point to me, but a Polish scholar I respect very, very much, and whose first book shaped this book deeply, a friend named Kamil Kijak, is now doing equally important work on a deep social and cultural history of Polish and Jewish political consciousness in the Kielce region. And some of the first fruits of that were, I think, are really bid fair to transform our take on how deep and how real, not the experience of anti-Semitism per se were, although that was happening, but, you know, just the ways in which real people on an everyday level, real Jewish people, were encountering amongst their peers real discourses that viewed them as the problem. And I think that's, you know, that is something that I saw a little bit in some of the autobiographies. There's a lot more to say there. And I think Kamil's book is going to be really important, really important. Beyond that, you know, look, I mean, I think we all, there's a double-sidedness to the old adage, which is undeniably true, I guess, that historians are always writing a history of the present. I mean, sometimes I think that means we denigrate our own efforts in the sense we think, well, we're really just reflecting a set of concerns today and everything will be different in 10 years. And so then the history will be different too. I've never been particularly partial to that view. I don't think that's really true. I think the present, you know, like Weber thought, I think the present can force us to think about things and therefore allow us to see things that really did happen. And I, you know, I think one of the things that helped me think about the problem of how people start to think about their own situation when they realize their previous categories of analysis and their previous expectations might have been wrong, that problem was brought home to me by the ways in which we, I think, have all discovered that, whatever our politics, you know, a lot of expectations coming into this decade or the past 10 years have been, we're forced to reconsider things like how fast do politics of enmity reshape political life? How strong are liberal institutions of rights and tolerance? These are questions that, you know, we're not imposing on the past. They're imposed on us by the present. And when we go back armed with that, we start to see things that I think really were there. So I unapologetically and unhappily, I'd much rather not have been forced to think this, I would say that the era we're in not just in the US, but globally, has very much forced, you know, helped me see these things. Although I also want to underscore the differences. And I also think, you know, the world of middleman minorities in newly developing nation states is a different, is a particular kind of world. And I don't know that the general sociology of sort of the politics of rage, hate, and enmity that we now live with goes all the way, I mean, fits entirely with the situation I wanted to study. But it helped me see that you could have a sort of history of thought groping or looking for new purchase because its bearers feel, recognize, and feel strongly that their previous categories have proven inadequate to their situation.
And we sort of, we see in the final chapter that this this groping that you're discussing goes so far as to place Jewish communal or national life in the future as an almost secondary concern to just survival. And I was wondering if you could describe what you think the consequences of that conclusion were for Jewish collectivity at the time, certainly, and maybe subsequently, if there is any effect of that particular mode of thought in that moment that it had on subsequent conceptions or models of Jewish collectivity.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard for me to answer the second. It's a question that's been raised to me a number of times, and in a number of different formulations. One of the most wrenching and interesting those formulations, I think Scott Urey asked me this years ago, and Siona, whose name I'm blocking, your fellow graduate student in Jewish history at Harvard, asked me this question. Did those who left Poland for Palestine under these circumstances, did this kind of non-ideological, let's call it yeshuvism, did it breed greater political decency when they got there vis-a-vis Palestinians and Palestinian aspirations and rights? And I have no answer to that. My sad gut sense is that it probably didn't. I mean, not certainly not systematically so. It may have done the opposite. I mean, there's a very interesting and unsettling moment in a very interesting Palestine travelogue by this figure named Yosef Chernichov, a longtime diaspora territorialist, but with a complex relationship to Zionism. And he goes in 1933, and one of the things he finds is, and he notes, is a sort of hard right politics about, you know, expelling Palestinians and this and that, taking shape amongst some of the recent migrants. Now, conversely, you know, a figure like a figure I discovered late in this project, a really fascinating figure named Lockerman, who's sort of a kind of zealot of progressive communal activism in Vilna all through the 10s and 20s. He's sort of active in every organization, working to better Jewish life on the ground. He's a very committed Yiddishist, but he ultimately decides to leave for Palestine for the sake of his family. His son Ezra Lahad will later on become both very much inside the Israeli secular Zionist sort of mode, lifelong military career, but also a very committed Yiddishist by his own lights and a kind of scholar of Yiddish theater. And Lahad writes shortly after the war about why his father made this choice. And he says, look, my dad just saw no future for us in Poland. And for him, this was a terribly wrenching in many ways, very sort of self-destructive undertaking, because he basically left behind all of his cultural hopes to come to Palestine. He made a very hard choice, a very clear choice between all the things he cared about as far as Jewishness was concerned, Jewish culture was concerned, on the one hand, and the needs of his children on the other, right? And that kind of calculus, I think, loomed larger and larger in as I did the research, and I got more and more convinced that part of the story that had to be told about a transformation in political culture, but also in a way of thinking, had a lot to do with a sense that probably one could not preserve all or even most of the things one cared about, that, or at least one had to start thinking in those terms, that maybe a lot of one's hopes had to be set aside, and much more practical questions about what resources one had to affect one's life or that of one's children had to be asked. And that was a form of thinking totally in tension with all of the great ideological projects of Jewish modernity. And to even renounce the notion that one can do much for most Jews, I mean, that really is striking. And this figure, Benjamin Reisch, I made reference to, and looms very large in the last part of the book. I mean, he says quite explicitly in his answer to Weinreich, or maybe it's in his autobiography, I have to remember, he says, you know, Zionism cannot help most Polish Jews. Nothing can. Nothing can. There's no medicine for everybody. And we're not going to find one. And no matter what you do, you're not going to find one. And in the meantime, we have to ask ourselves, you know, what can help at least some of us? And, you know, I think he's probably very uncomfortable asking that question. I can't ask him, but that's my sense. That it's a very discomforting notion that you just have to renounce hopes of helping the community as a whole.
Well, I think that's a good place to end the conversation. Thank you so much, Dr. Moss. We really appreciate hearing about your new book, and we hope that our listeners will go out and get a copy as soon as possible.
Well, thanks so much for taking this time, and I've really enjoyed our discussion. Great questions, and thanks to the listeners for listening.